And I think it was Bob Dylan who, one of his lines was, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And as a kid, I would say, what does that mean?
This photography podcast is brought to you by Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. Here is your today's host, W. Scott Olsen, with another fascinating conversation.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast from Frames Magazine. My name is Scott Olsen, and today, folks, today we are going to take a deep dive into taking a deep dive. We are going to talk about long-term projects. We're going to talk about how you uncover history and ethnography and anthropology and sociology and politics and architecture and all sorts of issues that inform really, really world-class, first-rate, important photography. In other words, we're talking with Barbara Mensch. Barbara has been described as a versatile fine art photographer who probes her subject matter with the curiosity and stamina of a detective. I loved that line when I read it, because if you know Barbara's work, that's dead on. There's a lot of detective work going on in here. We're talking about the Brooklyn Bridge. We're talking about the Fulton Sea Market down in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And we're also talking with Claire Gilliam. Claire, born in England, U.S. citizen now. Her work's been shown all over the place, including the ICP Library print collection. Barbara's work, of course, has been just seen everywhere. We're talking, you know, she's been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, New York Observer, Daily News. She's been on is it CBS Sunday morning? I forget which television show I just watched a minute ago. Exhibited all over the world. Just absolutely the very best of historically driven, culturally driven, neighborhood driven documentary photography, and a great deal more too. Barbara, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Oh, Scott, thanks so much for having me, and particularly for having Claire.
Claire, how are you doing today?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, this is going to be a guess. Barbara, I got to tell you, I'm one of those people, don't live in New York, but I've been there a lot. I've been on the Lower East Side. I can't tell you how many times. And so when I became familiar with your work, you were speaking immediately to my heart and my own curiosity. And I really do want to get to the Brooklyn Bridge project, the Sea Market project, into the new installations. But I'm doing a little bit of research and I'm, trying to figure out who you were before you became who you are. And okay, so you went off to Hunter, you're born in Brooklyn, you went off to Hunter College at 17 with an interest in drawing. Tell me about that early interest just in visuals, in drawing. I mean, why not, soccer? Why not the violin?
Well, thanks for finally someone asking me about drawing, because I never stopped doing that. And
really?
I started, yes, it's, something I continue, I'm sort of reinvigorating right now in my life, but I haven't really spoken or shown or shared much of that work right now. It's just not the time. But ever since I was a little girl growing up in Brooklyn, in the middle of these seething tenements and great anonymity to the blocks that I grew up on, I always wanted to get out of there. I never felt comfortable. So visually, ever since I was a little girl, I mean 3-4 years old, I started copying pictures out of calendars, of magazines, anything that looked like a faraway place, I would start to record in my sketch pad. And then to compensate for the frustration that I had by living in Brooklyn and living, in a neighborhood, multi-ethnic, the Italians, the Jews, and then the Irish, everyone, it was a very loud community. I mean, and people used to yell and scream just as, their natural tonality, frequency to their voices was always very high-pitched. And, people had arguments all the time. And so I longed, I yearned for some kind of calm some kind of peace. So I think...
Were you doing pastoral stuff, landscapes, sort of fantasy landscapes?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, I would just record, copying photographs. Initially, as a child, I was copying photographs because I had not yet gone to... we, of course, are blessed in New York with some of the greatest, you know, museums in the world. So it wasn't until I was 14 that my dad, who was a long-distance runner, started the, he and with his friend Fred LeBeau, started the New York Road Runners Club. So he used to go to the Central Park every Sunday, and they would train. So once in a while, he would take me with him to the Y and then to the Central Park. And then he would take me to the Met, remarkably. You know, my parents were working class and had very little background in anything cultural. And I remember the seminal experience I had. I was probably 13. And even though the Met switches around their permanent collection, they had a huge painting by this French artist, Rosa Bonheur, and it was called The Horse Fair. And at the time, I was also totally into riding horses. I still love horses, and I still want to get horses later on, but later on, better hurry up. And my father takes me by the hand, and, you know, we're reading the information, and he says, "Look, Barb, a woman did this. A woman painted this." And that changed my life, you know.
Really?
First of all, the painting was so gorgeous. And then, because I am curious, thank God, I looked her up. And, you know, this is not, you know, I also am in love with film and cinema. This is one that Hollywood missed, because she dressed up, disguised herself as a boy so she could get into the École des Beaux-Arts and do her academic training there. So it was a very important moment for me personally in terms of being impacted by the visual arts.
Oh, my. We could do actually an entire hour, I think, on photographers who draw or don't. I know another photographer, you know, who insists, landscape photographer, sketches the landscape.
Absolutely.
To spend an hour or so learning light and shadow before the camera ever comes up.
Of course.
But you must have been fairly good, though, because then you got a gig at Ms. Magazine as an illustrator.
Yes, I did. And that happened in my early 20s. And I remember, for me, drawing was everything, and I loved it, and I was really happy to do it, and I met some amazing people. I never met Gloria Steinem. I don't remember her in the offices, but, you know, I think at that point I wasn't politically inclined enough to seek her out. But the art director there, Bea Feitler, was quite brilliant, and she was sort of like a... you know, in New York, we've had our share of great graphic designers and great illustrators like Seymour Quest. And anyway, so those early gigs there, I was given what was called the Gazette page. And it was usually, it was like I would get, like, it was usually a couple of paragraphs about something going on that women should be interested in. And then I would do like a quarter page illustration. And, you know, it was just fascinating. But also at that point, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And it was incurable. And, you know, at that point, one of my dear, dear friends, John Mason, who I was very close with, he was my teacher at Hunter College. He's a world class. He just passed away. One of the most important artists in the field of creating ceramics into high art. He gave me his Pentax with a 50 millimeter lens, and I would take it out to Brooklyn when I went out to visit my mother. And after she got out of the hospital, which was very close to where I was going to school at Hunter, and I started photographing her reflexively because I knew she was, I was going to lose her. And that experience kind of pivoted me into photography because studio work as an illustrator or working on the canvas, so to speak, was also a very lonely, it was a very lonely experience. And sometimes, you know, you can understand that some artists are not that prolific. It takes them possibly a year to just finish a canvas. I mean, and just for an example, Edward Hopper, you know, he did a lot of drawings, but his paintings took him months and months and months and months and months. And then you have Vermeer, who left us approximately 43 works of art during his lifetime. So, you know, Van Gogh did that in a day. You know, it was like, so, you know, the whole experience of drawing and painting at that point in my life was less seductive to me than photography because it was more immediate. I could see my results right away. And it seemed to fit the need that I had then to have quicker results or to experience my work in a different medium. Although in my head, it was seemed to be all the same.
That answers sort of the next question I want to bring up, because it seems at this period of your life, you're doing all sorts of things which at first blush might seem a little bit opposed to each other. You're doing gallery inventory work. You're also playing around. You know, you're intrigued, and you're reading your bio here. You're really intrigued by the nuances of the darkroom. And yet you're also playing around with a Polaroid.
Yes.
And so, I mean, were you looking for a voice back then? What were the tugs?
Here's the thing. I think if you're a young photographer, a young artist, you're the whole idea of finding a voice, I personally, or a signature style, sometimes you have the need to experiment around with different medium, different ways of visual thinking until you arrive at something that feels more you. You know what I'm saying? So in my early work that I did, I just looked at the world in terms of more like frames. This is funny, Frames Magazine. Like frames. Like the first show I did was at PS1. I was the inaugural photography show.
Oh,
and
cool.
I got $100 honorarium, had to build the walls. My next door neighbor showing was Frank Gehry, showing these cardboard cutouts of these houses he was designing in Los Angeles. And this artist, Hannah Wilkie, who we know from all her feminist art, who passed away about 20 years ago, who was married to Klaus Oldenburg. It was like a whole thing. And for me, I was doing these serial images. Like I showed pictures of my mother, the last hours of her death, five images showing her in sequence, seeming to pass away. I put those on a sawhorse table. I had another project showing my girlfriend's pregnancy in a series, starting from when she first got pregnant to the end of the pregnancy, using her stomach as some kind of a landscape, like a hilly landscape. And the third one was this project I had done in the late 70s in Sonoma Grove in California, which I still haven't published. I still haven't done anything with. And it's one of my favorites, where I went to this trailer park.
Trailer park. And, yeah, it's on your website. Yeah.
And photographed these people who were manipulating. They were not just hippies, but they were people who just couldn't make it in society or needed to be. It was sort of like a unique form of subsidized housing, except visually. They would take these old school buses and parts of cars and create these, you know, only in California can you see this kind of creativity. And again, the project was serial, a group of pictures with quotes from
Something
them.
Went wrong.
So each project was self-contained and serialized.
It's, you've been working with long form, basically narrative since the very beginning, which is sort of odd because, you know, you've got that also beginning there of doing the gallery documents, you know, if there's a still life, that's what you were doing with that kind of stuff.
But excuse me for interrupting, but there's something important that I wanted to say that when I started doing fine art photography, we in our culture were not yet at that point where there were photography galleries. There were a few, if I remember correctly. It was Holden Luntz. It was like a handful of them, including one of my gallery supporters where I sold my first pictures through the Witkin Gallery. Evelyn Deitz was one of the most tremendous art dealers, and losing her has also been a big hole in my heart. But what I was going to say was that for me, earning a living, you know, people come on these podcasts and they talk about their work, and I'm always saying, how do you guys make money? I mean, that was always an issue. I mean, it was always an issue. I mean, you can't just call yourself this or that. You have to find a way to justify your work. Now, obviously, many people are lucky enough to have support. But at that point in my life, I didn't have the support. I had no family left. My father and my mother had early deaths. A family unit that was not that supportive. So I was on my own, pretty much. And when I moved to next to the Brooklyn Bridge, one of the ways I thought I could make money was by turning around and doing more traditional images. So my heroes then became, in the early 80s, when I did embark on this very long-term waterfront project, was the people whose work need I say more, Walker Evans, Berenice Abbott, artists like that seemed to me to make sense. And that really, the waterfront project really turned me off into a different trajectory.
Well, let me ask a couple questions about, it's the 80s, you leave Brooklyn, you move to Manhattan, Lower East Side, you're living there, you know, basically right underneath,
I'm the keeper of the Brooklyn Bridge.
But did you know you were starting a decades-long inquisition?
Of course not. These are the things that are revealed to you. You know, once you are enamored, engrossed, enthralled with something, and you want to know more, we don't know how deep down one can go. It's a matter of how far and how long you want to take your interest or your curiosity.
I am convinced a lot of people, after this podcast, they're going to go to your website, they're going to figure out the project. But for the people listening right now, sort of explain what you did here, because it is as much history and, anthropology, like I said, as it is photography. And I do want to tell you also, you have ruined my next trip to New York, because I'm going to those hidden spaces. I'm going to go find those doors. I'm not going to take the months to get permission, but now that I know they're there. What did you first think you were doing? How did that whole project evolve until finally what it became?
Oh, are you talking? You're talking now about In the Shadow of Genius, the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing: that when you live next to the Brooklyn Bridge, it's going to affect your life, whether you want to or not. It's there every day, and as I wrote in my book, in my personal essay, there was these doors. You have to understand, for anyone who's seen pictures of the bridge, don't think about the towers and the suspension bridge over the East River, but think about the two structures that bring the lanes of pedestrian traffic and the cars to either side of Brooklyn and Manhattan. Those are called the approaches and, of course, the anchorage, which anchors actually the remarkable fixings of the cables encased in the concrete. So the anchorages, the approaches, what I discovered by going through John Roebling's months and months and months and months of Mr. Roebling, Herr Roebling's brilliance, was that initially he wanted to use the approaches as a marketplace, as warehouses to store all the gold from the U.S. Treasury. And it was these underground tunnels and spaces were going to be used for that purpose. So I'm getting off track a little, but there were these doors, these metal doors on each side of the Pearl Street, which, again, you'll have to look at the picture. Anyway, these metal doors would continually be opened, and I noticed that there were construction trailers moving in, and it turned out that they wanted to repair, it was all over the news that the Brooklyn Bridge was falling down, so they had to repair the roadways onto the bridge. So they had to be shored up. So because the doors were open, I was very interested in getting in there because it was like going into Tutankhamun's tomb for me, you know, being the British archaeologist. What was it? Mm-hmm. Except they had curses on them. I think they both died after that, but we have to go back to that. I'm getting off, getting off. Anyway, so I had to lobby the city to get in, and that took time because the place inside was a rat-infested, degenerate, I can't say that on air.
Go for it.
Asshole. And I was shocked. I mean, this is our greatest, one of the greatest landmarks in the world. One of the most iconic images of America when you travel abroad is not so much the Statue of Liberty. It's the Brooklyn Bridge. It's everywhere on murals and cafes and buttons and chewing gum. I mean, forget it. So the experience of being inside and photographing inside really spurred my need, wasn't even a curiosity anymore, is to who were these principal creators of the bridge? How in God's name did they ever, ever in the 1800s, without computers, without any modern industrial techniques, be able to pull off a feat as grandiose as the Great Pyramids at Giza? Because it was basically the same thing. You're using manpower.
Let's take just a quick break. We hope very much that you are enjoying today's episode. The very fact that you are listening to this podcast suggests that photography means a lot to you. And if that's the case, you might want to have a look at Frames, quarterly printed photography magazine. We truly believe that excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit readframes.com to find out more about our publication and use the coupon code podcast to receive a recurring 10% discount on your new Frames magazine subscription. And now, back to today's conversation.
So how do you approach, you know, as a photographer, something so ever-present? You know, in world culture, how do you find the new thing to say?
Well, that's it. That was the daunting task. Why the Brooklyn Bridge? I mean, how many pictures are there of the Brooklyn Bridge? You know, I mean, come on, it's like the most photographed thing in the world. But I live next to it, and that's my bridge. I know, you know, I don't care.
You know? You actually bought that bridge when somebody tried to sell it.
That's how I feel. I'm very protective of it. And we could go on forever. I mean, the shutters in the warehouses were always open. And after 9/11, which of course is right outside my window as well, that those pictures, those horrifying pictures, which I never published, appear in the new book with the plane actually going in to the tower. So, it's a very exciting neighborhood to live in. So one day, I mean, we've had fires in there. The problem is that the Brooklyn Bridge has always been a terrorist target as well.
Right.
So I was always running, and, you know, the NYPD is also, all of these buildings are right in my purview. You know, the federal court building, the police building, the landlord-tenant court building, municipal archives. Everything's concentrated on Center Street, which is 5 seconds from my door.
It is a very cool part of town.
Yeah.
But for then, okay, so Brooklyn Bridge Project, how many years did you spend on that, by the way?
Oh, well, the research itself was daunting. Well, you have to understand, I've always been photographing the bridge, and just that, I never intentionally says, oh, I'm going to do a book on the bridge. It was an evolving interest, just like the Waterfront Project, which is section one of this new book, was something the more I moved through that man's world, the more layers I uncovered of fascinating, provocative images and oral histories.
Okay, fantastic transition, because I mean, it's after, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge, you walked an entire couple hundred yards a different direction and you wound up at the Fulton Fish Market. As a project. And I am such a fan of this project.
Oh, thank you.
Having been there in the 80s and in the 70s and stuff, and I know exactly where you are. And I start reading the story here, and you are my hero.
I'm coming to visit you.
Yeah. Okay. No, because I think every photographer, you know, that does any kind of documentary work or any kind of long-term project would love to have the dedication, the focus that you've got here, and, you know, the time and the wherewithal to say, I'm committing what this project needs to it, to do it right.
Yeah.
People may have heard the phrase Fulton Fish Market. When did you, and you didn't just go to the tourist thing, you didn't do the Chamber of Commerce, promotion. You went for something else there.
Well, here's the point. First of all, we always called it the market. It's something about fish market that I could never, I always hated that as a descriptive way, because for me, the market was this inner, it was this working man's world, the waterfront. It was a time when we have to understand that New York was a completely different place. Yeah. My neighborhood, particularly the East River waterfront, the west side by the Hudson River was a little different, but we had the Washington Market there, but it didn't have the mystique that the longshoreman fishmonger waterfront had for a long time. But you have to remember that lower Manhattan, with these huge economies contributing to the tri-state area, like the Fulton Market, which was the largest seafood market in North America.
Yep.
Okay, that's no, you know, it's not like, oh, it's this or that. This was an enormous billion, and I'm talking about the 80s, so billions of dollars in the 80s was a lot of money, continual income. But you have to remember, the audience has to understand that the mystique of New York, which has been portrayed in The Godfather, in The Sopranos, and a lot of these sometimes brilliant recreations of life in the underworld, was really a palpable presence at the time that I was wanting to photograph down there. And layering that on top of the fact that in the 80s, the corporate structure was gaining a certain prominence in America in terms of their power in the economy, their ability to make money at no cost. I mean, think about the Michael Douglas in, you know, Greed is Good, and, you know, Michael Milken's. But we had Giuliani was federal prosecutor back then. This is the irony of ironies. You know, the Southern District Court of Manhattan is the most prominent court in America, period, the end. The people that become prosecutors out of there are the cream of the crop. So we had Giuliani, who had a very twisted backstory, which the person who talks a lot about the mob in my book touches on. But the point is that the underworld activity down there crisscrossed with my time there. And that aspect of it only made me more curious, and only because the challenge became so great to allow for them to allow me in so I could embrace that historical document and visual treasure trove of images, became a long-term, dragged-out experience for me. And it was competitive. It was, who was going to win this? Was I going to actually get this thing to a point where I felt I told their story, or was I going to quit, you know?
The number of threads that are going on for you during this project are mesmerizing. It's middle of the night. You know, you are a woman walking around in a very, very tough male community. You have organized crime that's involved,
yes,
but pretty much just a protection racket. You know, not so much, you know, accounting organized crime at that time. But you have the government trying to get rid of that, and so they're trying to get rid of the whole thing. The FBI is sending photographers, but you're a photographer, so nobody knows if you're working for the FBI. Didn't you just pull up the blanket some night and say,
I did on the nights where I would get calls telling me not to come down. Because
from who?
From my friends.
Okay.
Because of it was just some very stuff that I remember as if it were yesterday. You know, once they realized that I wasn't an FBI, this took years. It just was crazy. They would call me if something bad was about to happen. You know, if there was a murder or, you know, some ugly event. So, and those things were real, you know, they were real. And I remember a guy got this phone call in the middle of the night, and one of my friends got on the phone in his gravelly voice, "Hey, Barbara, yeah, you want to stay in bed tonight? Just stay in bed, you know." And then in the morning, it was front page news in the Daily News that there was a hit in Chelnik parking garage, which was this underground parking garage around the corner where, that kind of stuff. And it was a very violent, to some degree, you have to understand, there were very, very few other ethnic groups that worked on the waterfront, except for the Italians, you know, most of them sons and daughters of the immigrants from southern Italy, which is also called a Mezzogiorno because of it was so hot that it was, you couldn't do anything till the middle of the day. And and then there were the Jews, and then there were some of the businesses that really went back historically into the 1800s. It was a remarkable thing because you couldn't to be accepted there and to be part of that community for any of the workers took a long time. It wasn't just me.
Now, you were taking most, I mean, this is an oversimplification, but most of the images you could call portraits, and, you know, individual men doing their work. You also tell a story in another interview about a man that you came to call your editor. Tell me what's going on there and why they would be concerned about just, I mean, here's some guy smoking a cigarette, you know, holding a hand truck. What was the risk for them? What was the risk for you?
Please think about it. Every night, mm-hmm. These are after the fishing boats finally left. One of my photographs, I don't know if it's in this book, the last fishing trawler to come to port, it was from the Carolinas, and they had harvested scallops. So they weighed them up on the dock. I think there's one in the new book. Just think about how much money was changing hands every night. And this is, you have to understand, it was an all-cash business. You know, right. People weren't using credit cards, you know, and doing, there was no computer, hardly any computers. Everything was done human to human, mano a mano. And if you didn't pay your bills, these issues were solved either violently or threats of violence, or in some of the bigger sheds, in the tin building and in the Newmarket building, they'd post these little notices saying who owed money, and they'd call them deadbeats. In other words, you'd get embarrassed. Wouldn't you love to do that to the people that you can't stand or that owe you money? I would love to. You know, those are some of the character traits in these men that I love. The fact that there was a certain kind of honesty in their dishonesty. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Bob Dylan who, one of his lines was, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And as a kid, I would say, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean?
So tell me about this editor.
What is it that you'd like to know? Because I still can't talk about him. He was a nice guy, you know, all right? Is that?
But somebody not working for a photo agency had to approve your picture.
Absolutely. You couldn't send, you could not, I could not show or share at that time. Thank God we didn't have Facebook and all these social media. I could never have done it anyway. No, this was based on a trust that if they were going to allow me to walk around that waterfront for as long as I wanted and to delve into areas that presumably were off limits to other photographers, then I had to play ball with them. And that was the right thing to do. As much as I didn't want to, there was no other way. And, you know, the thing about people that are from that world is that they're not very verbal, okay? You have to understand that things are, it's like if you're following anything but Donald Trump, it's got a very similar ring to it. I mean, you don't write anything down, you don't call anybody, you don't have a recording. It's by innuendo. It's by these codes of language. Remember Michael Cohen talking about the codes? You know, he would say things in codes. Well, it's the same thing. Hey, Barbara, are you doing good work today? What you got today? You know, and then I had one really scary incident when I was doing my interviews with this one kid. You have to remember that a lot of these people got their jobs because of relatives that went before them. This was like you passed down tasks. They weren't, you just couldn't apply for a job. If Johnny L his cousin needed a job, he had to come, he could possibly present him to the crew boss, and he would have to go through some tests. You know, you have to decide if that person's going to fit in to that particular group. So what happened was is that I was in, this was in Carmine's locker room. That picture's in the book. I cannot believe when I walked in there, it said, fuck the corporation. This is when, you know, they started thinking about building the mall and the fights started to begin between, you know, all the fishmongers, you know, and the mayor and the mega corporation, which was at the time called the Rouse Corporation from Boston. So I went up to the locker room with this guy, this kid. He wasn't a kid. He was probably then around 35, 36. His uncle was a very famous historical figure in organized crime during the 30s and the early 40s before he went to prison. And his uncle ran the union. You know, he separated the longshoremen from the fishmongers. So he was the head of the fishmongers union, local 349. I forgot the name. I believe it. Believe it or not, I actually forgot the number, which is right. You know, think about Johnny Friendly and On the Waterfront. You can't make this stuff up because this was real, you know. So his uncle ran the union. And so I wanted to get into the story with him, you know. So Carmine's locker, there was a bar there where all the wise guys used to hang out. And then on this floor above where the union headquarters were, okay, run by the union boss, you know. So so I wrote it all down. It was fascinating, unbelievable. And I learned all about which judges got paid off in New York and, you know, and just the whole relationship that he had with his other brother and, you know, how it all played into the waterfront politics and everything. So I had to bring this interview to my editor because I couldn't just not, you know. And he was fuming. He went nuts. He, remarkably, he didn't do anything to me. I was very lucky. But he, boy, did he bring that kid in. It was called, you know, calling him on the carpet. You know, you've heard that expression before. Yep. And what are you talking to that girl for? And you can't talk to, you know, I was the girl, you know, and it was like, and then he got thrown out of the market. A lot of these men who went against their internal codes of behavior would lose their right to earn a living. And for them, that was the worst possible punishment. So it was a very daunting thing. But yes. So
okay. So I mean, you're wandering around, you know, basically with a Rolleiflex back then. Fast forward. Renovation comes in, and suddenly here comes this, as you describe it, site-specific permanent installation where you and Claire, we're going to bring you back in here, you sat down and went through literally thousands of old images to create a story which is on video screens. The images are being presented electronically. When you got the commission, when someone said, hey, you know, we want you to do this, how did you even begin going through all these old prints, reimagining the story and deciding how to present this in this new, really sort of high-tech way?
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to introduce Claire into the conversation because I met Claire Gilliam at the ICP, the International Center of Photography, where I was teaching this one and only course, Fine Art and Photography, The Crucial Link, and she was assigned as my TA. And from that moment on, we became, you know, fast friends, colleagues, and she's been the greatest supporter of my work in terms of helping me, because we balance each other out, where I'm more, I can see things, I can envision them, I see them in my mind's eye, but Claire has the structure, even in her art, it's very clear that she's got a much better structural sense. So both of us seem to blend together. To answer your question, here is my answer. I had to first decide what I was not going to show. That was first thing, because
for aesthetic or political personal reasons.
Because okay. I was dealing with one of the biggest real estate developers in America, number one, who's mm-hmm. Claire will come in and tell me to shut up when the time is right. But here's the point. And the other component of this happy family was celebrity chef Jean Georges and the French, who also went in tandem, in partnership, in investment with Howard Hughes Corporation. Can you imagine right. Howard Hughes later on having his name on this real estate corporate magnate from Texas? I still don't understand it, and I never will. But I knew that this was going to be a general public thing.
Right.
And people, many of the people that were going to be coming there would be tourists. So I felt that my experiences down on South Street, this dark, gritty, subliminal violence, would, if I decided to really portray the market in a way that would scare people or they'd find it offensive, because people walking through an entrance and exit aren't in a building that's not a museum. You know, you have to be very careful because mm-hmm. they're not going to, as is in a museum where you're hoping that people will spend a couple of minutes at least absorbing the visual language. You know, I had to be very mindful of that. So what I decided to do is to follow my, it was almost a combination of my love for medieval and Renaissance panel painting and right. my love of film, of cinema, and tell a story about the place vis-a-vis a universal message. What is a universal message? Human beings at work. Human beings that were proud of their work. Human beings that actually interacted with other human beings. By the way, that's my last name. That's what it means. Mensch. Human being in German. I'm Übermensch. So I felt comfortable with that. I felt like, okay, and through the images, because every photograph of every one of those men showed this hard, withered, soulful portrayal of a world that no longer exists, certainly in that location. So once I filtered through all that, which took months and months and months and months, because not only was that a problem, but we also had to deal with these predetermined dimensions to these screens. So at this point, I think Claire.
Let's bring Claire in, but also describe that video wall for people. What you know, if all the screens are off, what are they looking at?
Claire, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. So we had two big walls of screens,
and giant walls.
And one of them had, I think, 21 screens, and the other one had 14. And we decided on creating a subject. So we had sort of a customers and salesmen and
still lives.
Still lives. Thank you, Barbara.
And each
screen was slightly different. And Barb, the issue that we had with determining which image would be on the screen was what would fit on these sort of rectangular images, given that Barbara's images are mostly shot in the square format or more square format. And so we had, as well as picking out the images that worked within the subject matter, we had to also try and figure out how to crop each image so that they would also work in the cropped format, because Barbara doesn't crop after the taking of the image. So that was the challenge, but it was interesting to kind of come up with this this whole sequence and a new way of thinking.
Claire, from your point of view, how do you curate a narrative like that? Because, I mean, you know, cropping, you know, and that kind of stuff, that, you know, best case, that's 10 minutes worth of work. You say, okay, you know, do this. But how do you go about aesthetically, philosophically stuff, you know, all those things, selecting and you know, curating that wall or those walls, so that you get, as you guys say over and over, a dynamic, ongoing, progressing narrative to the experience?
We actually printed out hundreds of pictures of
possibilities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we printed out the just like low quality images just to like cut out and paste, and we moved things together, we put things the images next to one another to see how they would relate, and
anchors the key images. Claire, I'm gonna add something. Well, here's the thing, Scott, what I want your listeners to know, that putting this together was pretty daunting because there were confines to what we could do. So what Claire did, her brilliance initially came from helping me to find the images on the wall that would anchor each story. And the other complicated part, there were a lot of moving parts, that each, even though you had a screen, even though when you look at the pictures online, it just looks like each picture looks like a still photograph, but it's really not, because each screen for the most part had embedded another image and another image so that they would become, each screen would have its own separate story. And then on top of that, we had a videographer that we worked with, which, Claire, you want to talk about Roger?
You know, we had to determine which images would work as a zoom. You know, we would zoom in on some images, and Roger, the videographer, who is fantastic, we spent many days working with him, figuring out which images would move in a certain way, and he would create a parallax. I think that was what it was called.
Right, mm-hmm. Yep. Parallax conversion.
It would look like you're moving through the image. The viewer would move through the image.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing to see. And not every image moved or shifted. We didn't want to create a lot of confusion. So it all had to be perfectly timed, and it was a very interesting, difficult thing to do. But Roger was brilliant. We couldn't have done without Roger.
Were there hardware issues with this? I mean, just, you know, plain old technical. The scan isn't working.
Yes, there were a lot of technical challenges because, as we mentioned. And we had the screens were pre-designed before Barbara was really brought onto the project. So we had to work with what we had. And they weren't the best high-tech screens. So there were some, given that we were working with black and white images, some of the color shifts, even with black and white, would be quite noticeable. So some images might look more blue tone, right, in tone, and more right, red in others. So
keep tweaking and tweaking and
we had to keep tweaking. And
Trevor, I think I spent collectively 2 months.
Yeah, it was an arduous process, and
the tweaking here is tweaking the screen, not the image.
Right. Well,
okay.
It was a bit of both, to be honest with you, because we had to. Barbara had these amazing high resolution images made to use. So we had these incredible images to use, and then when it got transferred. And well, actually, to be honest, we were working on a really great computer. Roger had a great computer, so the images looked really great when we were editing and figuring it all out. And then came the day when we had to put it. Actually, we saw it for the first time in situ on these screens, and some of the images looked quite flat. The contrast wasn't quite right. So that was when the hard work. It took a long time to tweak those, and the program wasn't a really sophisticated program. You know, it wasn't like Photoshop. It was like up the highlights, or you know, it wasn't a complicated.
Program. But here's the thing: I didn't anticipate having to make certain demands. That I had to make so that the installation to the person coming and going, you know, I demanded that it would have a certain kind of visual impact. And I think that both of us worked very hard to, it's almost like the Brooklyn Bridge when John Roebling, finally the bridge's designer, got so frustrated with American capitalism that when his son took over the bridge before he died, they overcompensated for the strength of the cables that suspended from the towers, the catenary curves. It's the same thing with us. We had to overcompensate for a lot of things that happened on our journey to put this together. So that in itself was fascinating, because you're testing yourself. You're testing your own limits as to what your acceptance, what's the word I'm looking for? You're testing the limits of the standards that you want to achieve. So, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, as visual artists, we both have a certain standard of how we want our work to be perceived and presented. And so when you're given a situation where you have as less control over that than you would perhaps like, that's where you have to sort of really compromise and try and overcome the challenges.
It is certainly worth it, because when I saw this for the first time, I was just flabbergasted. The black and white, you know, images on these screens, so that they're all backlit, they're all, you know, sort of coming out at you.
Yes.
Is a very different presentation than paper in a frame.
That I knew right from the beginning when I accepted this, that there was no way. Look, it's very important, I think, to talk about the current state of our culture, because for me, I have particular issues with our attention span to anything, to anything. So I knew, you know, just from a logical point of view, I would never put some gorgeous, fine art, precious, in frame kind of installation in this place. It would just not work because, you know why? People are on their cell phones and they just will not stand there. They just won't. That's number one. And number two, our whole culture now is about screens. I mean, that we live in screens. Mm-hmm. So it seemed to match the times that we're living in more than anything else. You know, I didn't want to present these precious photographs. However, I did install two large prints showing the interior of the Tin Building. And I created them on dye bond, which was a very new experience for me because it's a metallic, you know, it's the first time I've produced metallic prints. And of course, the Tin Building was made out of corrugated metal. So it like, and then the old steel fish bins were steel, you know, were tin. So it all, the material used for the still photographs was absolutely the right call. And, you know, so that really blended in nicely as well. And then we had over the elevators, which they gave us completely different screens than the ones we were working with on the walls. I felt, again, living in the 21st century, our lives are just about selling advertising or selling ourselves, which is, I'll shut up about that. So I took all the signage, you know, from my pictures that we had scanned and started developing this wall over, like when people are waiting for the elevator, they could look up and see these beautiful changing, you know, Fred Mullins and Sons and Fairfish, and it would just keep changing and moving. But I also had my oral histories, and the language that, I mean, over the elevator walls is some of my favorite, where I said to Claire, we have another project here. You know, we have.
And Claire went running for the hills.
Because it was not dealing with the pictures. It was dealing with the visual beauty of language, which, of course, is visual. So Claire's work since COVID has really been highlighted by her fascination with how we communicate to each other. I think the fascinating thing was that something that I had not anticipated initially or envisioned became something else as a result of just immersing ourselves in this project. So Claire, you want to talk a little about the language wall?
Yeah, I would. But I also wanted to just say, I think that using the screens allowed us to actually use a lot more of your photographs and tell a fuller history and story of what this neighborhood had been. Whereas if you had just used still photographs and frames, you would have had, like, I don't know, 10 images.
I would never have done it.
We had like 100 images. And then we were also able to, I was honored that Barbara entrusted me with her language wall, with the oral histories. She had collated all these, you know, back in the day when she was photographing these men, she would interview them, and they had some fascinating stories.
Amazing stories.
Yeah, really amazing stories, and the words they use and the language they use. So I thought it would be fantastic to include this to kind of get a sense of the kind of men that you're seeing on these walls, how they spoke and how they interacted with each other. And just, I mean, they're very entertaining, and I just thought, well, you know, it was a filmic way. Barbara's always talking about her interest and love in film. And so I wondered how we could incorporate that in a movement sort of way, and just taking a few key quotes from these oral histories and really highlighting them. So, it was wonderful to work on.
That is so cool. We are sadly out of time. I could talk to both of you for the next 6 weeks, I think.
We could go on.
Barbara, like I said, I'm a fan. This is really, this is not only excellent work, this is important and necessary work. And Claire, my Lord, the contribution you've made is unbelievable. Thank you both. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Well, thank you, Scott.
Frames, because excellent photography belongs on paper. Visit us at www.readframes.com.